that's 1-800s. You 2-800. 1-800s. You 2-800. Call before midnight tonight. So don't forget. That's 1-800. You 2-800. Operators are standing by.
This is Petey Pidge.
I am Mike.
J Mac.
Brutal Dudes.
Chris Schwartz, and I am the co-founder and CEO of Rough House Records, the home to many of hip-hop's greatest artists.
The Fugees,
Lauryn Hill, Cypress Hill, Criss Cross, Nas, DMX,
Wyclef Jean,
Kool Keith.
Boy,
and there's others,
much others. You know.
But we also have a lot of records too that we never talk about. And when I say records, like we had the fact.
Before you digress, finish your introduction, then I can talk about me.
Started at this place.
Studio
4 at 444 North 3rd Street.
But we started,
right?
But.
Well, no, but they're not there anymore. Go there, you're not going to find
them. So this is Phil Niccolo. I'm the Butcher Brothers production team. Me and my twin brother worked as the Butcher Brothers, producing all kinds of things from like Billy Joel, River Dreams, to Urge Overkill, blah, blah, blah. Lots of crazy records but mostly the 90s into the 2000s. And, multi-platinum Grammy Award-winning producer, blah, blah, blah. And, Look me up on the Interscope. It's fine. You'll see.
We got about each of us. We have between actually all three of us. We have close to 600 gold and platinum records.
True. Over the many years.
And that's a lot.
That is a freaking
lot. That is quite a bit.
And now I'm still mixing and mastering. I do a lot of mastering reissues for Universal. Just finished Janet Jackson's Velvet Rope 25th anniversary with a bunch of cool new songs. And stuff like that, you know, and as well as Chris and I are working with some really cool stuff. We 2 years ago started Studio 4 Vinyl, and we're now pressing vinyl records.
And that's something that I'm super excited to talk about as well.
To have
a vinyl record.
We did the 25th anniversary of Coolio, the new U2. We did a new Mount Joy record, all kinds of cool stuff. Anthony Green, It's really fun. We make some of the best records in North America because we're music people. So everybody there, Vincent, Richard, David, Ashley, all the people, Ronnie, Jeff Saito, we love what we do. So our records are sought after, and even companies like Disney are our clients, Frank Sinatra. Because again, we give a shit, you know. There's a lot of records out there,
and 26 labels under Universal Music Group, and Studio 4 Vinyl is the number one pressing plant of choice among 26 labels.
We're doubling our capacity, building a new facility in Coatesville, and it's fun. But again, for those we've been making records for so long. 5 years ago, if somebody said I'd be running a vinyl pressing facility, I'd say, yeah, when bats fly out of my ass.
Five years ago, somebody said to me that we would be, I mean, we are becoming the biggest independent distributor of heritage vinyl, hip hop on vinyl.
Yeah.
North America, which Wu-Tang actually means the world. RZA, Cypress Hill, Onyx,
B-Roll Solo.
We got a lot of the Griselda stuff.
The new Schoolie record is out. It's great.
It's the best record he's made. It sounds like it should have been the third record, right after Saturday Night.
He just called me yesterday. He was in a record store, and he said, man, I got to tell you never get tired seeing your record in a record store like on the wall. And he was like, you know, he's really proud of it. And so am I. We worked with it on it for a year. It was like we started it during the pandemic. And he started it 10 years ago. And I joined him about 2.5-3 years ago and helped him finish it and mix it and master it. And it's really good. It's like it's not old school. It's not like, oh, he sounds like he's still trying to do the same stuff. He is still Schoolie D, but what he's doing is as fresh as what he did back then. So it's kind of, you know, really cool, good music doesn't go out of style. And he's not phony. He's not trying to be gangster rap. Or he's not trying to be that idiom because he is that.
Well, yeah, he's
so it comes natural, so it doesn't sound phony and fake.
He did the first ever gangster hip hop record ever
issued. Only I told you we're going to talk about
it. Here's the amazing thing: what people don't know is that before he was a rapper, he was a painter. He got a special scholarship and to go to a school in Atlanta, and he is like, I mean, I went to see him last night, right? And now he's going through his abstract period, the Tom Bailey stuff.
He was telling me that. And he's been exhibited in MoMA in New York.
He made $175,000 at a gallery showing, you know? And wow. I it did help that I think Amir bought two paintings for $50,000 a piece, you know.
Yeah, well, but he really appreciated the work, and but Amir did. I wouldn't go crazy with the numbers
because
Amir was our intern 100 years ago.
Yeah, Amir started out with us. But we have we just put out Jungle Brothers. We had two side projects, Baby Bam, and Jungle Brothers proper, and then two side projects by them, and we got another Jungle Brothers record, Keep It Jungle. We're doing Stetsasonic. We got an Ultra Magnetic Cool Keith.
Cool Keith's coming next Wednesday to the pressing plant to hand make some records for the custom.
And Wilson's coming.
Ice-T.
We're doing
Greatest
Hits. Oh, nice.
And plus new songs, you know. We're doing the vinyl. As a matter of fact, we're so cool. Every night I go home and I do a lot of mastering.
It's like his first six records.
A lot of mastering.
It's called Crying Stories.
In the beta format, right? So I master in beta every night when I get home.
Masturbator.
Right?
I get it. It's a joke.
It's a celebratory thing that I get do. It. You know?
I get it.
And
there's like a cassette thing on the wall here, stereo cassette. I'm looking at the cassette. It's like a fake turntable with two sliders. What do they call those things? Faders.
Faders.
Groupers.
Yeah.
They're groupers. Mm. And the button, the big knobs. It's really random. I said we'd have to have some Basil Hayden. I don't see any. Do you see the Basil Hayden?
I don't see any of the refreshments we were promised.
I said, if you can't get Basil Hayden, then, you know, Jack will be fine.
No, but craft services are really, like,
underrated.
We take a dim view on you know, like, when people just don't show that special.
I do apologize then for that. I blame Jimmy, of course.
And Steve.
Yeah.
Steve, you know,
Steve is our live human remains.
But we would get mad if you guys ordered a pizza or something. I wouldn't get mad at that. You know what I mean? I like Dr. Pepper, by the way. I'm just mentioning that.
That's literally the nectar of the gods.
The Dr. Like Pepper?
They said it was sweet,
I don't see any. I don't see any either.
We do have Vanilla Ice's energy drink. So,
what's a Vanilla Ice energy drink?
I don't know. He's got a
ton. Joy Burst is his energy drink.
That's a little thing?
Wow. No, it's like an 8-ounce can, I think. Something like that. Cool. I do really have those if you want
one. Lots of caffeine.
So much caffeine.
I go within the speed limit, like you're supposed to do. You know,
he drives like your cataract-ridden grandmother, and it's just like, and I was like, Chris, we should. No, can't we? That's all right. I like to complain. I'm a whiner. I'm a
complainer. You say that's what Joyce. You take corners slower than Anthony DiPiano's. Well,
yeah, that's true.
We actually grew up half a mile from each other.
We didn't meet until Half Track in Half Track Studio 4 in Conshohocken. Okay. Yeah, we grew up literally within walking distance out there in Devon, Pennsylvania.
And how did Rough House come about?
Well, Chris, you could kind of give them the Reader's Digest story. I'll tell them. what happened was Chris brought Schoolie D. I'll give you the short one because Chris is going like a 2-hour dissertation. Chris brought Schoolie D into Studio 4 around 1984, was it? Yeah. Maybe. So Joey started working with them, and that's when I guess the first Schoolie D record that we worked on was which one
was the Saturday Night.
Saturday Night.
Saturday Night.
So Joey, you know, and this was early hip hop, and Joe was working with some of the earliest stuff then. And so Joe and Chris and Schoolie hit it off, and Chris was really in terms of the industry, he was one of the first people to really do street promotion and really get that street cred of getting records into record shops, into little like the Funko Mart and Sound of Philly and 8th Street and all that, and get that street thing of what hip hop was, because right. it wasn't national, it wasn't on the radio, but it was starting in this like real street cred thing. And Chris was really early in developing that connection.
Street teams, right? Because once we hit the Rockies, you were fucked. You can develop stuff in clubs and go. But once you hit the Rockies and the Prairies, that's it. So then you had to start getting people to do it for you in another city. So we got college kids who were just fans, and barbershops, pool halls, retail, anywhere. And the great thing about the time that you have a 12-inch record, you put it out Friday night, mix show, then the clubs, Saturday, in-store play by the DJs in the store, then mix show again that night. And you knew by Monday if you had a record. It was awesome. So
Joey and Chris started developing stuff. We started doing stuff at Studio 4, Roughhouse started as, I don't even forget what it was called before Roughhouse.
Pyramid Production.
It was Pyramid, and then
we couldn't come up with anything more ambiguous, though. It was really hard.
And according to Joey, as you guys were, you had to register the name for the company. He was at
we were both at Arthur Mann's office.
Shit, man! I told you I told turn the phone off. Idiot. All right, that's better. I turned my stop. Son of a bitch. He's our attorney, and supposedly you had to come up with the name. And Joe looked at a cassette on his desk, and it said Roughhouse.
R-O-U-G-A. It was really horrible rock band.
And these guys said, "Oh, how about R-U-F? Roughhouse, R-U-F-F-H-A-U-S-E." And boom, all of a sudden it was Roughhouse.
Yeah.
And it started, and at the time, I was working with, I did a lot of stuff in Philly. I was working with the band, the Hooters.
Oh, my dad went to high school with them.
Oh, well, the Hooters, I've worked on all their records since record one.
That's funny.
Well, Rick Chertoff was in producing the first major record for the Hooters on Columbia. And so we got to know Rick, and he then became the senior vice president of Columbia.
Right.
Wow. And he said, "Hey, this Roughhouse thing you're doing, why don't we, you know, we're starting to make a little noise. Why don't we bring it in through Columbia?" So Rick brought the whole scenario to Columbia. To who was the head of business affairs back then? I don't really remember.
Danny Wynn.
Danny Wynn. But it was like, I guess, Tommy Mottola and Donnie Honor.
Tommy Mottola.
What the hell? Blah, blah, blah. So
it was a little deal.
The first thing we put out was Chiba, right?
Chiba. And here's the thing. Chiba did not. We signed an artist, Sight Unseen, came to a friend of ours, Len Fico, and a song called The Piper, and it sounded really awesome. It was like, and so we get Chiba, we fly him back here, and he goes to the studio. He can't do the song, and he finally admits to us that it wasn't his song. It was actually Shock G from Digital Underground, right? But okay. He said, Shock said I could have the song to shop it, and I talked to the manager, H. and Gregory. He goes, yeah, Shock said he could have the song, but we couldn't get him to sign a mechanical license yet. And we shot a video. We saw this shit. And because Joe had him do it syllable per syllable till it sounded like the same song. And now it's like, how do we go to Columbia and tell them that, you know, this is we signed the wrong artist? I flew to Chicago and sat in the lobby and waited. H.N. came down. When he came off the elevator, he had it in his hand, the signed thing.
The first number one record was Tim Dog. Penicillin on Wax.
Song, Fuck Compton.
That was Fuck Compton and Step to Me. That Tim Dog record is incredible performance hip hop. It's the shit, but it was the very first number one.
Right.
And then
it was the first ever. 90s. It was the first ever music video that was sold as a commercial single
in stores. We couldn't, you know, it's fuck Compton. You couldn't get played in.
Right.
So we say it was, and admittedly, it wasn't our idea. It was somebody up at Sony's, but $9.99 for a VHS, and we sold over 100,000 of them.
Yeah.
For a $50,000 a year deal. Yeah. Right. And then, that was like, so we were already like.
And then, so that was, and then of course, shortly thereafter, all of a sudden, Crisscross, Cypress Hill, and then Fuji's, and of course, Lauryn Hill. So it just.
I remember Crisscross very vividly coming out.
Well, I mean, it came out in '93, and again, when we were working on it, I thought it was just like a novelty, goofy song. It was just kind of like
I didn't like it,
you know. And I mean, I wasn't. I mean, I worked on it because Joey and I worked on it. We did some of the remixes as Butcher Brothers. We mixed some of the song. I actually tracked the song, the Jump. Jermaine Dupri put that whole thing together.
Yeah, right.
Crossword. Well, everybody knows that story. You know, he found them in a mall, blah, 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 blah. So when it was about to come out, I'm like, I want my name on this thing. I said, damn, you can take my name off that crap. You know, whatever. Well, but then it comes out and it start, you know, it started off kind of okay. Wasn't it Living Color that kicked its ass?
Before the single and the video hit radio and MTV. The Rosie Perez was the talent coordinator for In Living Color, and as a favorite to a girl who worked up at Columbia Records, she put them on the show. Nobody knew who they were. I was in a diner and overbooked the next day. I was really hungover, and my wife was giving me a bunch of shit. And I hear this couple talking, this older couple, and the guy was going on and on about the performance of Living Color.
They closed the show that Sunday night, and it was like they were happened to be up in Philly. Because what's his name? Don DeVito, not Danny, but Don DeVito was doing promotion for it. And he said, "Oh, the kid's up, it's still up here." And we were like, "Yeah." And he said, "Can you bring him up to Fox in New York and shoot? You know, we want to close the last minute and 37 seconds of Living Color." So they went up, they shot the video, blah, blah, blah. They played it, they closed the show that night. That next week, from what I understand, by noon, Monday morning, every copy was sold.
Yeah.
And by the end of that week, they had pressed, it was on the way of pressing a million
of them. What was the record chain in Ardmore?
Plastic Fantastic.
No, not the independent, the chain. It was at
the chain.
It was at the end of a shopping, a strip
mall. Yeah.
Where the Chipotle's is.
Yeah.
I remember being in there, and there was a kid, and he was like, you know, 10 years old, and there was a stack of Crisscross cassettes like this big in the thing, and he's looking, he sees it and he grabbed it like that, like as though if he didn't get it right there in that second,
someone is gonna take that away. Yeah,
it was the fastest selling hip-hop physical product in you know ever.
And it was number one for 12 weeks.
Anytime
freaking weeks.
Anytime you could go into your car and I could find that song any time of day.
And here's the nutty, crazy thing about it. When we got to the point where we were recording the third, where people, everybody makes it, jump. Well, we were making it. So Joey said, "Hey, look, we just need a look." So everybody come into the control room, so it was me and Chris and Rose and Joe and Jeff and Mark and the people, you know, people in Studio 4. So we all went in, and of course we yelled, jump, and we recorded it, you know, the whole song. Okay, great, blah, blah, blah. Now it becomes it was number one for 12 weeks. So you're driving in your car, and every time you turn on the radio, you're hearing yourself and the
scream
people
you jump work at
with
you.
Yelling, jump, thousands of times. And you're like listening, it's like, that's me, Jeff, Joe, Jack. There was that's like, what the fuck?
It was the song that held the record surreal. Number one at that displaced. Was End of the Road by Boyz II Men.
Also recorded at Studio 4 that I also engineered.
How many times in a lifetime
will something like that happen? Yeah.
One for 12 weeks. So, of course, I was managed by Moyer Marie, Bennett Kaufman, great guy, in Los Angeles. And, of course, on the press release, it was like, Niccolo holds the number one position for almost half the year. As if I did 40 records. But they took 12 freaking weeks in a row.
They still play Jump at baseball games and football games. Absolutely. And they still play End of the Road at every prom or junior dance you're ever going to go to.
It's great.
That's awesome.
And talking about a complete difference, Jump, I thought, is a piece of junk. And it is. I'm not saying it is. But End of the Road, well, while they were recording that, and I guess it was Jamin Lewis who came and did that. I guess it was Jamin Lewis.
But End of the Road?
Well, anyway, while that was getting recorded, it was like, oh, this is going to be huge. Because it was
it was a great song. And, you
and Boyz II Men did their first two records.
They're always singing like in the stairwell, harmonizing in the hallway.
Oh,
it was, and it's like, it was just amazing just hearing these guys like,
here's an old offshoot. And it's the stories. It's about the stories. Boyz II Men recorded their first album in Our Place, Cool Town Marty, which is great, amazing, 6-time platinum, blah, blah, blah. So one of my engineers, Jeff Hinger, became their engineer, and he was their engineer for like 20 years. So they're getting ready to start the second record. So now all of a sudden they're popular, it's special, you know. Mm-hmm.
Boyz II Millionaires.
They book the A room, so they're working in the A room with Jeff. And I'm in B mixing on, you know, we have an E room, SSL room. So I'm mixing on the SSL, and Jeff kind of walks in and he looks at me. He goes, "Phil, can you come here a second?" And I'm like, "Oh shit, something's wrong. They're not, the caviar's too cold or something." You know? I'm like, "What's up?" He said, "Man, do you know the Beatles song Yesterday?" Yeah.
Scrambled Eggs.
Yeah, I know Yesterday. And they said, "Well, look, they want to record it, but we don't have a copy of it or whatever. Can you come over and sing it to them?" And I'm like, "You want me to go sing Yesterday to Boyz II Men?" Yeah, it'll be fine. And I'm like, "All right." So I go over to the A room. Now, I know the song, but it's not like I wrote it. So I'm going, "Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away." So I'm thinking, if I fuck this up, this is going to be awful. If they're going to record this version,
they'll be blaming you. They're like, "Hey, that's
not the fucking song." And I'm like, luckily I got it right.
It doesn't sound like original.
But thank goodness, you know. But so I got to sing Yesterday to Boyz II Men, and I suck, as you can tell.
The original placeholder title was Scrambled Eggs.
Scrambled Eggs, yeah. Paul McCartney woke up and he was like, he thought there's no way I wrote this because it's too cool, too iconic. Someone must have already written this melody, but no, he did. He didn't. He wrote it. So,
and then, it was while they were making
this random association.
Magical Night. It was during Magical Mystery Tour.
Yesterday,
he didn't write it while they were making that.
No. He wrote that, dude. They did that on Ed Sullivan in 1964. Man,
are you sure?
Yeah, I'm a Beatles fanatic.
Right. He does a multimedia presentation, sells out, and it's, the Beatles. It's photos you've never seen. Outtakes, multi-tracks, shit you've never heard from the Beatles.
About 4 or 5 years ago, I got to mix and master the track that he did with the Kanye West.
The guy that likes Hitler, right?
Kanye likes to wear the black hood. Hitler was just misunderstood. You guys don't understand.
We have a record. Kanye has a label. We're distributing the only record he's ever put out on the label. It's a group called Abstract Mindset.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
The guy in Abstract Mindset, childhood friends of Kanye. He said Kanye says shit that he doesn't even realize he's saying, and he won't remember it an hour later.
Well, that's good because he's like off the deep end. It does because when you see the stuff he says, you're like, I can sort of see what you might be thinking, but dude, you are so like crazy. Like on some level, the whole goofy Hitler thing, I think, comes from a come on, everybody can make a mistake attitude. But it's like
I don't know.
Can't go there with it. Sorry,
I don't know who it was.
Man,
Pablo Escobar admired Hitler, right? And you know, and Pablo Escobar, he was a legitimate businessman. You know, he was a successful what he did, right? And you know, so it's like what you know if that Pablo Escobar, he's a drug dealer, like you know, biggest one in the world, right? Kanye is just a producer who makes beautiful music. That's confused,
very confused. Know? So, but now it's like I mix a track with me and Noah Goldstein, who recorded it for them, and we worked together. I mixed this track with McCartney and Kanye West, and I can't tell anybody because they're like, Kanye West. It's like saying like Michael Jackson to a pedophile. Oh, Michael Jackson.
Everybody's like, oh, what's
I'm saying Michael Jackson's a pedophile, but I don't know. I never met the man, and he's dead.
But millennials are saying, isn't it great that Kanye gave this guy, Paul McCartney, a shot?
You know, yeah. It came out New Year's Eve, 2018, maybe, but At the Stroke of Midnight, it came out. And a bunch of fans were like, man, Kanye's giving this McCartney guy a real shot. It's like, mm-hmm. Yeah, that's okay. Young people, they don't know who the fuck the Beatles are.